As Goes Wisconsin. I am Dan Schaefer, filling in for Kristen Bry. As always, you can call or text anytime at 844-967-2789. Jane, after that last segment with Eric, are you excited for another Bucks playoff run?
I am, and I love everybody loves Giannis, right? Because he's just so lovable, and he is for so many different reasons. But I have a thing for Brooke Lopez.
He's great.
He is great, and he's really cute. So now you know my interest in basketball. Okay,
he had a great game last night.
He did.
Must have enjoyed last night because he had hit 7 threes. Incredible game for Brooke Lopez. We are going to be joined by another guest here coming up in the 12 o'clock hour, and she is here and ready to join us. We have Amanda Heidemann, the political science professor at Marquette University, joining us today. Amanda, welcome to As Goes Wisconsin.
Well, thank you for having me.
You wanted to talk. I asked you before we came on about what you wanted to talk about, and you said you wanted to talk about misinformation and the midterms. So we're still kind of rehashing the midterms here on the show. You know, obviously a lot to dissect, a lot to think about. But you wanted to talk about the role of misinformation, and in Wisconsin, I feel like we got a little bit of that over the course of the campaign.
Yeah, I would say so. And I think that misinformation was definitely a big concern on a lot of people's minds leading up to the midterms. And even though, you know, while political misinformation, we're talking about this sort of, you know, broad concept, includes a lot of different topics that can range from, you know, crime, immigration, issues of public health. Much of the focus was on misinformation about voting this time around, much of which stems from the falsehoods about election security and voter fraud that originated in the 2020 presidential election. So the big lie. So we saw some conspiracy theories about, you know, mail-in ballots. Some voters were getting anonymous text messages warning them to stay home. There were some threats of violence that were, you know, sort of floating around on alternative social media sites. But fortunately, it seems like Election Day came and went with what seems like relatively few incidents. You know, of course, there were some normal Election Day issues, you know, to be expected in a kind of large election that have resulted in the emergence of some misleading framing that does imply harmful intent, particularly I'm thinking about Maricopa County in Arizona. Where they had some issues on Election Day with tabulation and printers, even though election officials very, very quickly, you know, they were very transparent, very quickly addressed this, clearly communicated those issues and what they were doing to solve them. We still saw some of these issues sort of floating around the internet with, you know, sort of being manipulated with misleading framing and tying them to this broader established theory of election fraud. So we saw some of that cropping up, but there were also some claims in Pennsylvania focused on some misleading explanations about how long it takes to count votes, which I think is kind of also what we're still seeing floating around.
Yeah, I think there's been, obviously, within the past 2 years in Wisconsin, there's just been a mountain of nonsense when it comes to the election denying, misinformation, you know, mischaracterization of so many different things. I know, you know, the ballot timing or the timing of the release of the Milwaukee results was a frequent topic of misinformation throughout, you know, the lead up to the election. So I think there was some real concern going into that night. I know the folks at the Milwaukee Elections Commission put out some information in advance saying, kind of telling reporters when they expected that vote drop to be, just as they did in 2020. You know, obviously a little bit of heightened attention to those votes in Milwaukee. It always seems to be such a focus in Milwaukee, doesn't it?
Yeah, it really does. Yeah.
So like you mentioned, that it's across the country, there was a lot of misinformation about the elections. But we also had a situation, at least here in Wisconsin, where the candidates have accepted the results. Are we going to be going back to a situation where candidates accept results and concede? It seems so strange now.
Yeah, I mean, let's hope so. But it was strange times, right? I think we were all kind of waiting. We saw very clear concessions very early on, and it's like a proper democratic process.
Amanda, with all of the fear mongering about early voting and the drop boxes. Did this come back and bite the Republicans in some way?
I mean, I would say that, you know, it seems that running on a platform of, you know, election denialism was not a winning strategy. But I mean, until we have more data, you know, we can really dig in and then, you know, analyze that data. It's hard to say. But.
Yeah, I think we at least have one candidate who has not yet conceded. You mentioned Arizona and Maricopa County. Carrie Lake has lost the election. She lost by pretty much an identical margin to the 1% margin that Mandela Barnes lost by in Wisconsin. And, you know, the morning after the election in Wisconsin, Ron Johnson was all fired up, angry that the networks had not yet called his race. Soon after he sent a statement out, they called the race. He was mad that there were some Republican radio talkers saying that Mandela Barnes was trying to steal the election. But of course, he gave a public concession speech shortly after the networks called and he conceded, and after he talked to Ron Johnson and all that. That's not what's happening with a remarkably similar margin in Arizona, is it?
No, not that I've seen so far. Maybe while we're on air now, it'll happen. But yeah, no, which, I mean, it seems like a difficult claim for her to make, even in, you know, as candidates like even Oz, right, also conceded on election night.
Oz conceded, Mastriano conceded, Tim Michaels conceded. We've got all of these different examples of these, you know, election denying Republicans who had, you know, carried this mantle for the last 2 years of sowing doubt in the 2020 election. And I think is Carrie Lake the only holdout, or is this a pretty prevalent thing throughout? It seems like she's probably the only holdout at this point.
Definitely the most visible holdout at this point.
Yeah. So what have been some of the other, you know, examples of misinformation? We're here with Marquette professor Amanda Heidemann, who studies misinformation. And, you know, what are some of the other examples beyond the election denying stuff that kind of came up throughout the midterms?
Probably you're still seeing some residual like COVID-19 and vaccine misinformation floating around. But my focus has primarily been on election denialism and voting.
Yeah. So do you think going forward in Wisconsin, we've had so much, you know, with the Gableman investigation lasted 14 months. We had a chair of the elections committee in the assembly, you know, call hearing after hearing to deny the election. Do you think the fever has broken at all, or do you think this is just a temporary pause?
I don't know. I'm not in the business of prediction. I don't want anyone to come for me. I mean, let's hope, right, that we've broken the fever, that democracy lives to see another day. But I guess, you know, time will tell. If only we could see into the future.
Yeah. So any other, you know, as we kind of reflect on the midterms here in Wisconsin, the role of misinformation, yeah, obviously it seemed like it played a big role, not only in, you know, the election denying stuff, but also, you know, it's just kind of over the course of the campaign and with the advertising. Wisconsin saw so much advertising. Jane, I haven't seen an ad in a week. So
I'm lovely?
Having like withdrawal symptoms here. I want to hear Mandela Barnes say the word resources over and over again. So we heard so many, we finally get this break in the advertising. I think, you know, the governor's race was, as has been well reported, was the most expensive governor's race in the country. More than $100 million spent on that race. And I think the Senate race was even more expensive. I think numbers I saw that had close to $150 million spent on that Senate race. I think it was the fifth most expensive. And I would not exactly say that the advertising was super honest throughout that process. What are your thoughts on the role misinformation played throughout that process?
Coming from like elite communication and rhetoric, absolutely. So I've been thinking about this a lot. You know, we know that like misinformation is always going to be a problem. There will always be a supply and a demand for all kinds of nonsense. You know, and there might be more or less of it floating around social media. You know, and I think definitely questions about how we should be structuring and monitoring, regulating the public sphere are definitely, you know, really key, right, as our efforts to understand why people are susceptible and how they can become more resilient, sort of inoculating themselves against misinformation. But I think the problem goes beyond just, you know, sort of misinformation floating around on social media. We live in a world where, you know, we can't agree on a common basis of facts. And, you know, part of the blame should be on elites and elite communication. I mean, political science research tells us that elites play a key role in shaping voter issue positions. You know, this elite-driven model of public opinion formation. So I think we also need to kind of turn our attention to these broader sort of macro forces.
What do you mean when you say elites there?
Our politicians, right? Yeah. People running for elected office, people currently serving in elected office.
So people that probably should be able to hold themselves to a little higher standard than, say, like the Facebook comment section under a news story. It seems like we've had a lot of politicians who have seemed like, you know, a human version of the comment section that have been more and more prevalent in our politics in recent years.
Yes, a sentient comment section, if you will.
A sentient comment section. We've had a lot of candidates these last couple of years that could perhaps be characterized as a sentient comment section. I've referred to Ron Johnson in the past as a sentient version of just conservative talk radio. So maybe the sentient comment section is perhaps a cousin of that. So we're here with Amanda Heidemann. She is a political science professor at Marquette University. She is going to be joining us for the rest of the half hour here. We're going to get into some other topics as well as we continue to just kind of rehash the midterms. We spent so much time, you know, in the run up to the midterms talking about what might happen and what could happen. And I think, you know, it's even though it's been a couple weeks, I don't know, time doesn't matter to me anymore. It's been 11 days? No, not even. I don't know. It's been some time since the election. I need to recombobulate myself. That's what I do as the recombobulation area. Amanda Heidemann is here. She's going to be continuing to join us for the next segment. My name is Dan Schaefer. I am the founder and writer and other stuff at the recombobulation area, and you're listening to As Goes Wisconsin. We'll be right back. Goes Wisconsin. This is Dan Schaefer filling in for Kristen Bry. And we have been joined by Marquette University political science professor Amanda Heidemann, who is here to talk about what I think is a really important topic as it relates to the midterm elections and just kind of politics at large. Where we are right now is the topic of misinformation. And we were talking about in the last segment about the role that misinformation has played in this election and really has, you know, taken kind of center stage in American politics since the 2020 election. And for this next segment, I want to talk a little bit more about, you know, some of those root causes of misinformation in American politics. That's a topic that you know well. So what are some of those root causes of those misperceptions in American politics right now?
Yeah. So, I mean, typically the misperceptions that result from these conspiracy theories and misinformation and disinformation that floats around in various media sources, you know, perhaps even just elites, right, communicating this in their advertisements, it's typically rooted in what we call motivated reasoning. So this shapes how people search for, how they evaluate, now they incorporate information into their beliefs. So we're often seeking out information that reinforces our preferences. And we view pro-attitudinal information as being much more convincing than counter-attitudinal information. And so some, you know, observable implications of this include selective exposure to our media sources, right, inside of our, you know,
those
media
bubbles that we always hear about, right?
Yeah, exactly, right? Not really hearing diverse perspectives, You know, and of course, we know that the quality of that bubble also varies greatly, right? There's definitely a spectrum there. And so then we also end up with this motivated processing of the information that we receive from whatever, you know, source that we're seeking out. So we tend to accept and recall congenial factual information much more frequently than uncongenial factual information. So, and then of course, then we're interpreting those facts in a belief consistent manner. And, you know, this of course then can exacerbate the continued influence of, you know, false or misleading information, even after it has been debunked.
Mm-hmm. So those media bubbles that we're always hearing about how we're in, those are a pretty big deal. It's important to get outside of your bubble.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. So, I think I feel like we heard a lot about just the importance of that media bubble after the 2016 election, when people are like, how could Donald Trump possibly have won? And everybody's like, well, you're in your little urbanite liberal media bubble, blah, blah, blah. But I think we're seeing in this most recent election, you know, I think a lot of Republicans thought that a red wave was coming, that they were going to have these huge gains in the House. I think a lot of, a lot of the conservative commentators, be it on TV or on the radio or whatever, were predicting a red wave. And that was, you know, not a totally unreasonable prediction, right? That's typically what happens in a midterm election year. But I feel like there is, you know, an under-examined part of this is that, you know, liberals kind of went through this post-Trump in 2016. Do conservatives need to have a reckoning with the bubble that they're in as well?
Probably, right? the midterm results would definitely suggest that, something is definitely going on there.
Yeah, I think so many of the people in Wisconsin are just like, oh, Tim Michaels is going to win. Ron Johnson's going to run away with this. We're going to get the supermajority, you know, and such was not the case. This is not the big swing that we saw, you know, in perhaps like in 2010 with the Tea Party or you know, even 2018 with the kind of, I don't know, are we still calling it the resistance? I don't know, that term seems a little off now. But, I think those media bubbles, are really something that has perpetuated and is, you know, in the age of algorithmic social media that, you know, populates your feed with all these things that are, you know, like-minded voices, you know, what are some of the ways that kind of people can get out of that besides just, you know, reaching out and doing the work to find what the other side is saying?
I think maybe going back to following like local journalists, right, on the ground, doing the day-to-day reporting. And just, you know, broadening your media diet, you know, click away from the Fox News or the MSNBC for a little bit.
Truly, Amanda, though, and that's what I found most valuable on Twitter. I follow more journalists and historians, and I have just found that to be incredibly valuable. And I've learned so much, like you said, by opening up your sphere. And at least with historians, for the most part, they're dealing in facts. So that's always good.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, and speaking of just, you know, how to sort of inoculate yourself from, you know, not just broadening your media diet, but inoculating yourself, sort of protecting yourself against, you know, falling victim to false or misleading information. There is some research that suggests that, you know, there's sort of this method of what journalists are calling pre-bunking, explaining the tactics used to manipulate people, to people as a way for them to then protect themselves, right? Mm-hmm. Understanding the logic behind some of this misleading and false information.
So kind of understanding where the conspiracies are headed and trying to get out in front of it, which I think there was a lot of journalists who did a pretty good job with that in this election in particular. I think, you know, having gone through the 2 years that we have post 2020 with all the ridiculousness has perhaps prepared people for, hey, this is when Milwaukee's votes are going to come. This is how the votes are going to get tallied. And it's just, I feel like a lot of local news really did a good job with that. You know, a lot of local TV news. This is the life cycle of a ballot. Like all those different types of things. Mm-hmm. I think that really, really helps people. And so, you know, hopefully we will continue to have a healthier media diet, have a healthier approach to misinformation. Amanda Heidemann, thank you so much for joining us here today on As Goes Wisconsin.
Thank you so much.
All right, we are about to head to our next break here, but after the break, we are going to be joined by Greg May of 1,000 Friends of Wisconsin. We're going to talk about I-94 expansion. Topic near and dear. Tell me lies, tell me sweet little lies.